Chapter 4. The picked screen was a flexible thing like cloth, and it hung from the eaves of the armory chamber alcove in the manner of a tapestry. Cables trailed away to shining brass sockets in the walls, streams of data feeding images from the ship-to-ship Vox network. The view was a live signal, attenuated by interference from the Horologi star, and although it appeared to be instantaneous, it was actually a few minutes behind the real events. The transmission slowed by relativistic physics. Not that such a fact seemed to concern the Astartes gathered to watch. The display came from remote scrying pictures on the bow plane of Barbarus's Sting, a light frigate that had been tasked to follow the Yorgul worldship on its last journey. The images were being recorded for posterity. The better views would doubtless be worked into stirring newsreels for distribution across Imperial space. The world ship's drives flashed red, and tongues of fusion flame erupted from their nozzles, each one as long as the Sting. At the edges of the picture, it was possible to see the glints of smaller craft, shuttles and thunderhawks, escaping the world ship with the last of the Imperial forces on board. The pictures rotated to follow the monolithic craft, and smoked filters faded in as the Iotan sun hove into view. The world ship was accelerating away, gaining speed with every passing moment. The controls for the propulsion system captured by the Death Guard of the Second Company had been locked open by the adepts of the Mechanicum. Barbarus's Sting kept a respectful distance, drifting after the bottle world, framing its descent towards the sun. Great loops of crackling electromagnetic energy shimmered around the pearlescent cylinder as it cut into the star's invisible chromosphere, destroying the solar panels of the aft. They crisped and burned, folding in on themselves like insect wings touched by candle flames. The world ship fell faster and faster, dipping into the raging superheated plasma of the photospheric layer. Hull metal peeled away in curls a kilometre long, revealing ribs of metal that melted and ran. Finally, the alien vessel sank through a glowing coronal prominence and disappeared forever into the stellar furnace.
"Gone," muttered Brother Mokir.
"Ashes and dust. As are all the enemies of the Death Guard. A fitting end for such Xenos hubris."
A swell of self-congratulatory mood passed through the assembled men of the Second Company. It was they who had made the sundive possible, after spending their blood and fire to take the heavily defended engineering domes from the Yorgul. It was fitting that they were witnesses to the alien vessel's final moments.
"I wonder how many survivors were aboard,"
said a sergeant, watching the star's rippling surface. Mokir grunted.
"None."
He turned and grinned at his company captain.
"A fine victory, eh, Commander?"
"A fine victory," repeated Grulgor in a rancorous tone. "But not fine enough."
He shot a hard look up at the gallery, where Garrow stood in conversation with his Primarch.
"Curb your collar, Ignatius. For once, try not to wear it like a badge upon your chest."
Typhon drew near, the rank-and-file Astartes parting before his approach.
"Forgive me, First Captain,"
Grulgor retorted.
"It is just that my collar, as you put it, is apt to suffer when I am forced to witness the unworthy rewarded."
Typhon raised an eyebrow.
"You are questioning the Primarch's decisions? Careful, Commander. There is sedition in such thoughts."
He drew close to the other man so that their conversation would be less public.
"Garrow rescues women and kills newborns. And for that, he is given a draught from the cup. Have the standards of the Legion fallen so low that we reward such behaviour?"
The First Captain ignored the question and answered with one of his own.
"Tell me, why do you object to Nathaniel Garrow with such vehemence? He is a Death Guard, is he not? He is your battle brother, a kinsman Astartes." Straight arrow, Garrow.
Anger bubbled up through Grulgor's mocking reply.
He's not fit to be a Death Guard. He is high-handed and superior. Always looking down his nose. He thinks himself so much better than the rest of the Legion. Too proud and too good for the rest of us.
Us?
Asked Typhon, pushing the commander to say what he knew was there just beneath the surface.
The sons of Barbarus, Kallus. You and I, men like Ugeorge and Holgorg, the Death Guard who were born upon our blighted homeworld. Garrow is a Terran, an Earthborn. He wears it like some sacred brand, always reminding us that he is our better because he fought for the Legion before it was given to Mortarion.
Grulgor shook his head.
He pours scorn on my company, upon our brotherhood and comradeship of our lodge. Too haughty to mix with the rest of us outside of rank and rule. And do you know why? Because his precious birthright is all he has. If he wasn't favored by the Emperor with that damned eagle cuirass he wears, he wouldn't be allowed to ride the hem of my cloak. Temeter is a Terran-born, and so is Huron Fal, and Sorak, and countless others within our ranks, said the captain levelly. Do you detest them as well, Ignatius?
None of them drag the old ways around like rattling chains.
None of them think themselves a cut above the rest because of their birthplace.
His eyes narrowed.
Garrow acts as if he has the right to judge me. I will not tolerate such condescension from a man who grew up watered and well-fed, while my clan fought for every breath of clean air.
But is not Mortarion himself a Terran? Typhon asked with a wicked smile, daring Grulgor to go further still.
The Primarch's place of birth was Barbarus, insisted the commander, rising to the bait. He is and always will be one of us. This legion belongs to the Death Lord first and the Emperor second. Garrow should be reminded of that, not given praise he does not deserve.
Bold words, noted Typhon.
But I'm afraid you may be further disappointed. Our Lord Commander has not only granted Captain Garrow the cups today, but will also take him as equerry to the War Council at our next port of call.
Grulgor's pale face flushed crimson.
Did you come to mock, Typhon? Does it amuse you to parade Garrow's favours in front of me?
The line of Typhon's jaw hardened.
Watch your tone, Commander. Remember to whom you speak.
He looked away.
You are a true Death Guard, Grulgor. A blunt instrument, lethal and relentless. And you are loyal to the Primarch.
Never question that,
growled the Astartes. Or I will take your head, first captain or not.
The threat amused the other man.
I would never dare to do such a thing. But I would ask you this. How far would your loyalty to Mortarion take you? To the gates of hell and beyond if he commanded it.
Grulgor's reply was immediate and absolute. Typhon watched him carefully.
Even if it was against the will of a higher authority.
Like the Sigilite,
snapped Grulgor.
Or those wastrels filling the Council of Terror.
Or higher still.
The commander snorted with bitter laughter.
The Death Lord first, the Emperor second. I said it and I mean it. If that makes me of lesser worth than men like Garrow, then perhaps I am.
On the contrary, nodded Typhon.
It makes you all the more valuable.
There are great powers soon to bloom, Ignatius, and men of your caliber will be needed when those moments come.
He threw a dismissive glance up at the gallery.
And what about him?
Typhon shrugged, a peculiar gesture in the heavy plate of his armour.
Nathaniel Garrow is a good soldier and a leader of men, with the respect of many Astartes in this and other legions. To have him at the Primarch's side, as you say, a man so staunch a Terran, when a time of decision came to pass, that would carry much weight.
Grulgor sneered.
Garrow has a steel rod up his backside. He would break before he would bend his knee to anything but the rule of Terror.
All the more reason for the Primarch to keep a close eye on him.
Typhon's gruff voice became a rough whisper.
I, however, see the reality in your viewpoint, Ignatius. And when the moment of choice comes, and Garrow does not fall into line...
You might require the services of a blunt instrument, yes?
A nod. Just so.
The commander showed his teeth in a feral smile.
Thank you, First Captain,
he said in a louder voice.
Your counsel has been most soothing to my ill humour.
Endurance tore itself from the mad fury of the warp and crashed into corporeal reality once more, leading the Death Guard flotilla into the wide-open diamond formation of the 63rd Expedition Fleet. Garrow, once again in his full battle armour and honour kit, stood behind and off to the side of his Primarch, as Mortarion observed the War Master's forces from the Assembly Hall. Flanked by the Death Shroud, Garrow's commander stood with one hand pressed to the thick armour-glass window that formed the right eye socket of the giant stone skull on the ship's bow.
"My brother seeks to impress us," Mortarion said to the heir. "The sons of Horus have indeed assembled a mighty force in this place."
Garrow had to admit that he had rarely seen the like, not since the days when the Emperor himself led the Great Crusade. The darkness was thick with ships of every type and tonnage, and the space between them swarmed with auxiliary craft, shuttles and fighters on perimeter patrols. The arrowhead arrangement of the green and grey liveried Death Guard ships slipped carefully into a pattern cleared for just that purpose. To the far starboard, across the bow of Typhon's flagship, the Terminus Est, he spied the ornate purple and gold filigree of a cruiser from the Third Legion, the Emperor's Children, and high above, at a different anchor, blue and red-trimmed craft from the 12th Legion, the World Eaters. But what caught his attention, and held it firmly, was the single great battleship that orbited ahead of them all, isolated in its own halo of open space and screened by a wall of sleek Raven-class interceptors. A heavy ingot of fashioned iron, the War Master's vengeful spirit radiated quiet power. Even from this distance, Garrow could see hundreds of gun turrets and the slender rods of massive accelerator cannons that were twice the length of the Endurance. Where the Death Guard ship displayed a skull and star sigil, Horus's flagship had a massive golden ring bisected by a slim ellipse. The eye of the War Master himself, unblinking and open to see all that transpired. Soon, Garrow was to set foot aboard that vessel, carrying the honour of his company with him. Repeater lights set into a control panel beneath the windows clicked and changed, signalling that the Endurance had come to her station. Garrow looked up at his Primarch.
My lord, a Stormbird has been prepared in the launch bay for your egress. We are ready to answer the War Master's summons at your discretion.
Mortarion nodded and remained where he was, observing silently. After a moment, Garrow felt compelled to speak again.
Lord, are we not ordered to attend the War Master the moment we arrive?
The Primarch grinned in a flash of rictus.
Ah, Captain. We move from the battlefield to the arena of politics. It would be impolite of us to arrive too soon.
We are the 14th Legion, and so we must respect the numbering of our brethren. The Emperor's children and the world-eaters must be allowed to arrive first, or else I would earn the ire of my brothers.
We are Death Guard, Garrow blurted. We are second to none.
Mortarion's smile widened. Of course, he agreed. But you must understand that it is sometimes tactful to let our comrades think that is not so.
I do not see the merit in it, Lord, Garrow admitted.
The Primarch turned away from the viewport.
Then watch and learn, Nathaniel.
In the confines of the Stormbird's Spartan crew compartment, Garrow once again felt dwarfed by his commander. Mortarion sat across the gangway from him, hunched forward so that his head was only a hand's span from the battle captain's. The Death Lord spoke in a fatherly tone. Garrow listened intently, absorbing every word as the small ship crossed the void between the Endurance and the Vengeful Spirit.
Our role at this war council is an important one, Mortarion said. The data you hold in your hand is the lit taper for the inferno that is about to engulf the Istvan system.
At this, Garrow opened his palm and studied the thick spool of memory wire there.
We bear the responsibility of bringing the news of this perfidy to the War Master's ears, as it was our battle brothers who came across the warning that Istvan has turned from the Emperor.
Garrow examined the coil. It was so innocuous an object to contain so volatile a potential. The little device hardly seemed capable of representing the death warrant of entire worlds. Before they had departed the Endurance, the Primarch had shown Nathaniel the Pict record contained on the spool, and the images left him with a chill that he found difficult to shake off. He saw it again, the recall fresh and close to the surface. Garrow had watched the terrified face of a woman loom in the Assembly Hall's hololithic tank, a shape of haze and shade like some mythical spirit bent on haunting the living. She was a minor officer of the army, a major. At least she was somebody wearing the uniform of one. Garrow saw glimpses of a stone stockade's walls among the jumping shadows, the dance of orange light from a chemical candle. Perspiration made her sallow face gleam, and the slender tongue of flame reflected from her anxious green eyes. When she spoke, it was with the voice of a person broken by horrors that no mortal should ever have lived to witness.
"It's revolution,"
she began, pushing the words from her lips like a desperate curse. She rambled on, speaking of rejection and of superstition, of things a line soldier like her had never believed could be real.
"Prowl has gone mad," she growled, "and the war singers are with him."
Garrow's brow furrowed at the names, and his master halted the replay, providing an explanation.
"The noble Baron Vardus Prowl is the Emperor's designate imperialis on the capital world of the system Istvan III.
She means to say the governor of an entire world broke with the rule of terror to throw in with some pagan idolaters?"
Nathaniel blinked, the idea unconscionable from a man of such significant rank within the Imperium.
"Why? What madness could compel such a thing?"
"That is what my brother Horus will have us learn," intoned the Primarch.
The Astartes studied the woman's face, blurred in mid-motion as she turned to look at something out of view of her Pictor's lens.
"The other word, warsinger, my lord, I am unfamiliar with it."
He wondered if it was some kind of colloquial name, perhaps some sort of honorific.
"They were a local myth, according to the records of the 27th expedition that enforced compliance here over a decade ago. A cadre of fantastical shaman warriors. Nothing but anecdotal evidence of their existence was ever found."
Garrow's master was circumspect, and he tapped the hololith controls with a slender finger, letting the recording run on. With an abrupt violence, the woman drew a heavy stub pistol and shot and killed something indistinct at the margins of the image pickup. She hove back into view, filling the screen, her unchained panic leeching out through the hologram.
"Send someone! Anyone!"
she pleaded.
"Just make this stop!"
Then there was the scream. The sheer wrongness of the noise, the utterly alien nature of it, made Garrow's gut knot, and his fingers tightened reflexively around a bolter trigger that was not there. The impact of the sound beat the woman down and shredded the Pictor's image control, shifting the replay into a stuttering series of blink-fast flash frames. Nathaniel saw blood, stone, torn skin, and then silent darkness.
"No word from the Istvan system followed this," said Mortarion quietly, allowing Garrow to measure and understand what he had just viewed. "No Vox transmissions, no Picta relays, no astropathic broadcasts."
The battle captain gave a stiff nod. The scream had cut through him like a knife edge, the echo of it a weapon turning to pierce his heart. Garrow shook off the eerie sensation and turned back to his liege lord. Mortarion explained that by pure chance the distress signal had been picked up by the crew of the Valley of Halos, a supply hauler in service to the 14th Legion. Suffering a dangerous Geller field fluctuation while in transit to the Death Guard's 6th Company flotilla at Arcturan, the Valley had emerged from the Immaterium to effect emergency repairs. There, as the ship drifted in space at the edge of the Istvanian ecliptic plane, the desperate message had found purchase. Data addressing the rate of energy decay, pattern attenuation, and the like were scrutinized by tech adepts, revealing that the transmission had been flung into the ether more than 2 years previously. Garrow considered the frightened officer he had seen on the hololith and wondered about her fate. Her last awful moments of life were frozen and preserved forever, while her bones lay out there somewhere, forgotten and decaying.
"Did the crewmen of the Valley detect anything else of import, Master?" he asked. "Perhaps if the men aboard the transport were fully debriefed..."
Mortarion glanced away, then back.
"The Valley of Halos was a casualty of the Arcturan engagement. It was lost with all hands. Fortunately, this recording of the Istvan signal was conveyed to the Terminus Est before that regrettable event."
The Primarch spoke with a leaden finality on the matter that Garrow felt compelled to accept. The Death Lord placed the spool in the battle captain's hand.
"Carry this burden for me, Nathaniel, and remember, watch and learn."
Inside, the vengeful spirit was no less impressive than it had been from a distance. The vast open space of the landing bay, so wide and long that Garrow imagined it would be possible to dock a starship the size of a small cutter in here with room to spare. An honour guard slammed their fists to attention in the old martial manner, saluting with hand to breast instead of the usual crossed palms of the Aquila. The battle captain kept pace behind the Death Shroud and Mortarion, while Garrow, in turn, was followed by a contingent of warriors from Typhon's 1st Company, their lockstep footfalls pulsing like ready thunder as the 14th Legion's contingent marched on to the War Master's flagship. Garrow could not help but glance around, taking in as much as he could of Horus's vessel, committing everything he saw to memory. He noticed other stormbirds on landing cradles in the process of refueling for return flights, one adorned with the snarling, fanged mouth of the World-Eaters, and another trimmed in regal purple with the golden wings of the Emperor's children.
"My brother Fulgrim has not graced us with his presence," murmured Mortarion, casually dismissing the purple stormbird with thinly veiled sarcasm. "How like him."
Garrow peered closer and saw that the ship did not fly the pennants associated with the carriage of a Primarch. Indeed, he recalled that there had been no sign of the Firebird, Fulgrim's assault ship, among the warfleet. He found himself wondering if this was some element of the politics that his master had spoken of before. Garrow frowned. He had always fancied that the Primarchs were an inviolate fraternity, comrades of such exalted status that they were beyond any petty emotions like rivalry or contention. But suddenly such thoughts seemed naive. Astarte's warriors like Garrow and Grulgor were raised above normal men, and yet they still disagreed in their manners, more often than Nathaniel would have liked. Would it be surprising, then, to learn that the Primarchs, who stood above the Astartes as much as the Astartes stood above mortal men, were also prey to the same differences? Perhaps it was a good thing, Garrow decided. If the Primarchs were elevated too far towards godhood, they might lose sight of the fact that this was the Imperium of Man, and it was for the good of the common people of the galaxy that they served the Emperor. With a silent member of the Sons of Horus leading their party, the Death Guard contingent moved across the cavernous bay to where a new train carriage awaited to speed Mortarion to the Baudex of the Vengeful Spirit and the Lupercal's court. Garrow let his gaze turn upward, to the maze of skeletal gantries and walkways overhead, some heavy with cranes and weapons pallets, others ringed with catwalks for servitors and crewmen. It seemed oddly static up there for a working starship in preparation for a major combat operation. The battle captain had expected dozens of figures clustering in the metal galleries to observe the arrival of the Primarchs. Even aboard so illustrious a ship as the War Master's personal barge, it would have been a rare occurrence for parties from not two but three other legions to be aboard at one time. He looked hard, expecting to see men from Horus's legion watching the proceedings, but saw only a handful, a scattering of deckhands and nothing else. Garrow shook his head. Had the circumstances been reversed and the War Council been taking place on Endurance, he would warrant that every Astartes on the ship would have come to see. It seemed as if something were missing.
"What troubles you, Nathaniel?"
The Primarch had halted at the new train and was studying him. Garrow took a breath, and the nagging thoughts in his mind abruptly crystallized.
"I have been told, Lord, that the 63rd Fleet carried a substantial contingent of remembrances with it. Considering the import of this day's meeting, it seems strange to me that I see not a single one of them hereabouts to record it."
He cast around with open hands. Mortarion raised a pale eyebrow.
"Are you concerned that your heroic profile will be rendered incorrectly in some poet's doggerel, Captain? That your name might be misspelled or some other indignity?" "No, my lord. But I had expected that they might mark such an uncommon moment as this gathering. Is that not their function?"
The Primarch frowned. The Emperor's edict to introduce the army of artists, sculptors, composers, poets, authors, and other sundry creatives to the fleets of the Great Crusade had not met with positive response from his sons, and despite the insistence from Terra that the endeavours of the Astartes were to be documented for posterity, there were only a few in the legions that were willing to tolerate the presence of civilians. Garrow himself was largely indifferent to the idea, but he understood, in an abstract way, the value that future generations of humanity might gain from true accounts of their mission. For his part, the master of the Death Guard had been careful to ensure that the ships of the 14th were always engaged elsewhere, somewhere beyond the reach of the Remembrancer delegations that were part of the larger expeditionary fleets. Mortarion's character, like that of his legion, was inward-looking, private and guarded in the face of those he did not regard. The Death Lord considered the Remembrancers to be little more than unwanted intruders.
"Garrow," he replied, "those gangs of ink-fingered scribblers and salon intelligentsia are here, but they do not have the run of the fleet. The War Master informed me that there was an incident in recent days. Some Remembrancers lost their lives because they ventured into areas that were unsafe for them.
As such, tighter controls have been placed on their movements. For their own safety, of course.
I see, replied the captain. For the best, then.
Indeed. Mortarion entered the carriage. After all, what we discuss today will be its own record. There will be no need for scribes or stonecutters to immortalize it. History will do that for us. Garrow took one last look around the bay as he ascended the boarding ramp, and from the corner of his eye a swift movement drew his attention. He glimpsed the figure only for a moment, but his oculobe optic implant allowed Nathaniel's brain to process every facet of the moment with pin-sharp clarity. It was an elderly man in the robes of an iterator of some senior rank, quite out of place in among the steel stanchions and rail tracks of the landing bay. He was quick and furtive in motion, keeping to the shadowed places, intent on some destination that he seemed fearful of ever reaching. In one of the iterator's hands was a fold of paper, perhaps a certificate or a permission of some kind. The old man was puffing with effort, and almost as soon as Garrow registered him, he was gone, ducking into a companionway that disappeared within the depths of the warship. The Death Guard grimaced and boarded the tram, the curious moment adding more definition to the sense of ill ease he had felt from the moment he had arrived on the Spirit. What should one think of a place that was named the Lupercal's Court? The title had great vanity to it. It seemed to come with a sneer on the lips of the sons of Horus, as if the chamber were in some manner a pretender to the grand court of the Emperor on distant Terra. Garrow marched in at his rightful place, his chest stiff inside his ornamental cuirass from expectant tension. He did not know what to anticipate before him. The battle captain had seen the War Master in the flesh only once, and that was in passing, as he led the 7th Company in review by the stands during the great parade after Ulanor. But there he was, seated on a black throne upon a raised dais beneath gales of sullen, uncommon banners. There were other people in the room, he was sure of it, but they were dim reflections of light and colour off the blaze of presence that was Horus. Garrow felt a curious twinge in his legs, as if almost by muscle memory he felt the urge to kneel. The War Master. He was indeed every iota of that, a perfect sculpture of the Astartes ideal on the stone chair, handsome and potent, radiating chained power. Robes laced with cords of white gold and copper pooled around him, cascading over the basalt frame of the throne. He wore armour of a kind Garrow had only seen before in artworks, intricately worked plates of emerald-tinted flex steel with vambraces made of black carbon. Pieces of Horus's battle gear resembled elements of the older Mark III iron armour and the current Mark IV Maximus type, while some parts were more advanced than anything used by the Death Guard. An exotic pistol that appeared to be fashioned from glass nestled at the War Master's hip in the folds of an animal skin holster. If anything, Horus seemed barely restrained by the bonds of ceramite and metal he wore, as if one mighty flex of his shoulders might split and throw them off. Even at rest, the Lord of all legions was a supernova made flesh, ready to detonate into action in an instant. The gleam of the slit pupil eye of Horus glared from his chest, catching the brooding glow from drifting glow globes. With a near physical effort, Nathaniel tore his gaze away from the being before him and pressed down the churn of emotion he felt. Now was not the time to be awestruck and unfocused, addled like some neophyte novitiate. Watch and learn, Mortarion had ordered. Garrow would do just that. His eyeline crossed that of another Astartes on the dais in the new green livery of Horus's renamed legion, and he nodded in brief greeting to Garviel Loken. Garrow had once shared a bunker with Loken and some of his men during the prosecution of the orc invasion of Crypt. The Death Guard and the Lunar Wolves had fought together for a week across the frozen plains, turning the blue ice dark with Xenos blood. Loken gave him a tight smile, and the simple gesture served to ease Nathaniel's tension a little. Nearby, he saw the other members of Horus's inner circle, the Mournival, the warriors Torgadon, Aximand, and Abaddon, and an odd thought struck him. The body language of the four captains was subtle, but not so understated that Garrow could not read it. There were lines of stress drawn here. Loken and Torgadon on one side, Aximand and Abaddon on the other. He could see it in the way that they did not meet each other's eyes, the lack of the easy camaraderie that Garrow had come to think of as a key characteristic of the War Master's Legion. Was there some concealed enmity at large within the Sons of Horus? The Astartes filed the information away for later consideration. His Primarch had correctly surmised that the Lord of the Emperor's Children was not at the gathering. In his stead was a ranking officer whom Garrow knew of through first-hand experiences, from crossings in battle that underlined the man's less than complimentary reputation. Lord Commander Eidolon and his troops were clad in war gear so elegant it made the Death Guard in their grey and green trim seem utterly featureless in comparison. The Legion had a reputation as dandies, preening over their armour and decorating themselves when other warriors looked to battle. And yet the wicked hammer carried by Eidolon and the swords of his men spoke to obvious martial skill on their part. Still, Garrow could not help but think that the Emperor's Children were overdressed for the occasion. The other presence in the room was almost as imposing as Horus, and the battle captain found himself measuring the Primarch of the World Eaters against his own liege lord, as the two leaders exchanged a neutral look. Where Mortarion was tall and wolf-lean, the Primarch Angron was thick-set and heavy. The Death Lord's pale aspect was at the far end of the spectrum from the Red Angel's clenched fist of a face, eyes deep set among an orchard of scars. Angron's mere presence leaked the coiled potential for feral violence into the chamber. As Mortarion embodied the dogged, silent promise of death, so his brother Primarch was the personification of raw and murderous aggression. The Lord of the World Eaters stood broad and deadly in bronze armour and a heaped cloak of tarnished chainmail that trailed the smell of old blood in the air. A cadre of his chosen men were at his side, led by an Astartes that Garrow knew by reputation alone, Khan, master of the Eighth Company. Unlike Eidolon, who was known for braggadocio, Khan's name was synonymous with brutality in battle. There were rumours of slaughters Khan had caused that even the most ruthless of the Death Guard found difficult to stomach. Garrow halted as Horus spoke, the voice commanding his total attention.
"With our brother Mortarion, we are complete."
The War Master stood, and once again Garrow fought off the urge to kneel. From a shadowed niche near where Nathaniel stood, a lipless servitor operated a control, and the court's lamps dimmed as a hololith bloomed before them. He recognised Istvan III from the picked slates he had seen at Mortarion's hands, orbital shots taken by long-range images, some hazed by the bright shape of the planet's largest satellite, the White Moon. This, then, was the world where the vile seed of Vardis Prahl's treachery had taken root. Horus spoke with keen urgency, each word sounding across the chamber as he repeated the details that Mortarion had given to Garrow on the Stormbird, describing how years earlier the Primarch Korax and his Raven Guard had left Istvan in good order to be turned to the Imperial Way.
"Are we to assume that the truth didn't take?"
Eidolon interrupted, his tone arch and sardonic, and Garrow shot him a disdainful look. It seemed the Lord Commander's poor manners had not improved since last he had seen him. Horus ignored the outspoken Astartes and instead gestured to Mortarion, who took up the thread of the briefing, moving on to the matter of the distress signal. Nathaniel knew his cue and proffered the memory spool to the waiting servitor, which dutifully loaded it into the hololith console. The message unwound and played to the assembled warriors. Instead of watching the recording again, Garrow slowly let his gaze cross over the faces of his brother Astartes, searching for some measure of their reaction to the dead woman's panic and terror. Khan mirrored his master Angron in his impassive mien, the very faintest twitch of a sneer pulling at the corner of his lips. Eidolon's haughty expression remained in place, apparently dismissive of the dishevelled and unkempt condition of the messenger. Horus was unreadable, his face as calm as that of a statue. Garrow looked away and found the men of the Mournival. Only Torgadon and Loken seemed affected, and of them Garvial looked to feel it the most. When the horrific killing scream came, Garrow had steeled himself against it, but still felt a churn of revulsion. He was watching Loken at that moment and saw the son of Horus flinch, just as he himself had aboard the Endurance. Garrow openly shared his comrade's discomfort. The dark message the distress signal carried was not just a call for help, a cry for the Astartes to leap to the defence of innocence. It was something much deeper, much more sinister than that. The Istvan recording spoke of duplicity of the most base and foul kind, where men of the Imperium had turned back to the black path of ignorance and done it willingly. The mere thought of such a thing made the Death Guard feel sick with revulsion. At Istvan, it would not be Xenos or criminals or foolish men blind to the Imperial truth that they were to face in combat. This foe had once been their comrades in the Emperor's service. They would be fighting tainted men, turncoats and deserters. Traitors. The disgust churning in him turned hot and became ready anger. Garrow's mind snapped back to the moment as the War Master showed them the Coral City, the seat of government on the third planet of the system and the source of the signal. The attack was to be huge, with elements of all four legions, platoons of common soldiery, and Titan war machines converging on Vardas Prahl's base of operations in the Precentor's palace. Nathaniel absorbed every detail, committing each element to his memory. The mention of his Primarch's name caught his attention once more.
"Your objective will be to engage the main force of the Coral City's army," said Horus, directing his words to Mortarion.
The battle captain could not help but feel a swell of pride when his master spoke up after the Supreme Commander had laid out his orders.
"I welcome this challenge, War Master. This is my legion's natural battlefield."
There would be one objective to complete before the assault on the Coral City began, and that was a raid to silence the monitors on Istvan Extremis, the outermost world of the system, and home to the nexus of its sensor web network. Once blinded, the defenders of Istvan III would only know that retribution was on its way. They would not know where or when it would strike.
"Aye,"
whispered Garrow to himself, staring into the depths of the hololith and the sprawl of urban complexity it presented. The Coral City would make a demanding theatre of combat, but it was one that Nathaniel was already eager to explore. The rest of the order of battle was swiftly laid down. The Emperor's children and the World Eaters would target the palace, and the War Master's own legion would attack an important religious shrine to the east, a vast cathedral complex called the Siren Hold. The name resonated in his mind, and once again Garrow turned the strange words over and over in his thoughts.
Sirenhold. Warsinger.
Unbidden, the alien phrases brought back the creeping sense of unease and a cold foreboding that would not release him.